seduction was a way of overcompensating and proving to myself that I was straight. As the three of them respond supportively, I still feel like an imposter. My trauma is woefully inadequate compared to theirs. Even here, in a hospital of misfits, I don't fit in. Chapter 18. Chicago, 26 years earlier.
Take off your shoes.
I know, Mom.
And put them on the mat, not the carpet like last time.
Yes, Mom.
Now go wash your hands before touching anything. It's too hard for me to keep cleaning your dirty fingerprints off the walls.
Okay, geez.
And don't forget, dinner is at 6 o'clock sharp. Don't be late or you won't get dessert.
I walk to my room to wash my hands. There is no television there, no phone, and no technology except a small stereo. It used to be the Beatles whose music soothed me. But now that I'm a little older, and my voice is starting to change, hardcore seems to fit my temperament better. I'm in the mood to play the Damned's Smash It Up, but I smashed the record in a fit of anger after I was grounded for a weekend for putting my feet up on the kitchen counter. So instead, I crank Suicidal Tendencies as loud as I can without getting into trouble. They just keep bugging me, and they just keep bugging me, and it builds up inside. And I wash my hands like a good son. A few minutes before 6, I hear my mom's voice.
Dinner time!
I enter the kitchen and see her sitting at the far end of the table, my father on her left, and my brother at the end closest to me. I'm the last to arrive, as usual, the black sheep. I sit down in my appointed seat.
Neil, elbows off the table. Ivan, you too.
Her voice is gentle for me, but harsh for my father. He is the blacker sheep. I feel bad for him, but my mom constantly tells me, "You're your father's favorite," as if that's a bad thing, so I try not to show him any sympathy.
You'll never believe what your father did to me this time. He told Robin in his office we were going to Sarasota for vacation. I have half a mind to just cancel the trip. You two haven't told anyone, have you?
No, Mom, of course not. But it isn't. When everyone in school brags about where they're traveling for Christmas break, it's hard not to tell them where I'm going. But my mother forbids it. She's worried that while we're gone, someone will break into the house. Before every trip, she hooks up lights to timers to fool all the criminals she imagines lurking outside. My father and I then leave the house and pretend to wave goodbye to my mother and brother. Afterward, they wait until the coast is clear, then sneak into a taxi to follow us. Even at my age, I know we have very little to steal. Just 2 small television sets, 2 stereos, and 1 VCR. I'm also not permitted to know my mother's age, where she went to school, what her past jobs were, or why her leg is deformed. And I'm not allowed to have keys to the house, and never will be, because she's worried I'll lose them. However, my brother is sometimes trusted with the keys to the house. It doesn't seem very fair. Sam's going to Jamaica, and he's allowed to tell everyone. I've always been jealous of Sam. His parents are divorced, and he's a latchkey kid, which means he gets the keys to the house. He can also stay up as late as he wants. Until recently, my bedtime was 7:30.
Well, Sam's parents don't care about what happens to him, and he's just like his parents. I don't want you hanging out with Sam, Neil. He has a big mouth. Anything you tell him, everyone in the neighborhood is going to know. Do you understand me?
Yes, Mom.
He's not your real friend anyway. Now, what did I tell you about switching your fork to your other hand after cutting your meat? That's better. Who's your mother who loves you very much?
You are. As I write the family rules on my timeline, I suddenly realize, no wonder I hate monogamy. It's just another irrational rule I have to put up with. Chapter 19. In the art room the next morning, I quickly finish my last rule. Don't trust other people. They are out to hurt you. And race to join the guys in group therapy. Joan storms into the room a few minutes later, carrying a stapled printout. My picture is on it. She looks at me and blurts, "Are you here for research?" "Research?" "I looked you up online. I know who you are." She seemed merely to dislike me before, but now she may actually hate me. She knows what I've written. Articles and books about sex-crazed rockers, porn stars, and players. A sex addict's oeuvre. And evidently, she thinks my sole purpose here is to undermine her. I'm 100% here for me, I tell her truthfully. What I don't tell her is that if I were undercover writing about sex addiction, I wouldn't be in this genital detention camp. I'd be with the sex addicts in the real world, having fun in Thai go-go bars and Brazilian termas and German FKK clubs. The truth is, this is the last chance for me to have a normal relationship, I continue. If I can't be convinced that monogamy is natural and healthy, and wanting to be with multiple women is a symptom of dysfunction and trauma, I don't think I'll ever want a regular marriage. Joan's arms are folded. She studies my every micro expression closely, waiting to see if I'll smile or break eye contact or show any sign that I'm lying. When I don't, she clucks sharply. Are you aware that any man who courts a woman with the goal of having sex is an addict? I tell her I wasn't aware of that, and she goes on to explain that couples should have 17 dates and fully get to know each other before initiating any physical contact. But sex, I think, is part of getting to know someone. What if you commit to a relationship and she's horrible in bed, smells like balsamic vinegar, and refuses to give blowjobs? She waits for me to challenge her, but this time I keep my thoughts to myself. She then uncrosses her arms and nods her head. Go ahead and present your timeline. I unroll the butcher paper. It's the size I was when I was 10, and sit on a floor next to it. I tell her about the rules, the paranoia, the punishments, and the tough but compassionate babysitter who came to live with us when I was 2 and became like a second mother to me. When I get to the story about my mom's wish that my brother and I cremate her and leave no memorial, my face swells and I feel tears approaching. Joan responds to the possibility of tears in the room, like a shark to the scent of blood in the water. What are you feeling? She asks, as if inviting me to cry. She has me right where she wants me, submissive, vulnerable, open. Pain, I tell her, because just saying that makes me realize how sad she must be inside. How lonely and empty she must feel that she just wants to disappear from the world without any trace of her existence left behind. I inhale, clamp down on my emotions, and try to suck back the tears through the sides of my eyes. I will give Joan the story, but I won't give her my soul. I don't trust her with it. When we move into my teenage years, I tell her about my parents never trusting me with the keys to the house, not letting me go on my first ever date, and grounding me for most of my high school years. And then suddenly, I stop presenting my timeline. I've reached the part I've been dreading. I have a family skeleton in the closet here, I explain, but I promised my mother I'd never tell anyone about it, so I don't know what to do. I don't want to lie or break that promise. This is your recovery, Joan replies, and you're as sick as your secrets. You can't keep old promises if they're not healthy for you. Yes, but I have my own value system. Just like we've taken a pledge of anonymity here, I pledge secrecy to my mother. Then we will all make a pledge of secrecy to you, she says, and they all promise. One more thing, I add. Just say it, she snaps, annoyed. I ask more questions, buying time so I can determine what's right. I crave the release, but I dread the betrayal. And then, as I look at the faces of the other guys who've shared their secrets in this room, I decide that, after 2 decades, I just need to let it go. Maybe it's been holding me back, keeping me stuck in the past and riddled with confusion. And so I share what I've never told anyone, not Ingrid, not even my brother. Okay, so one day I was in my father's closet looking for porn. The words start slowly, as if waking from a deep slumber. And I found this videotape. The first thing on it was a tennis game with people in wheelchairs. Then there was a clip from a movie with a woman in a wheelchair begging in the streets for change. Then a swimming race with all these people with no limbs just wriggling in the water. And at the end were all these old film clips of... It's hard to go on. Everyone is silent. Amputees. All these models in bathing suits with missing legs and shit. That's when I first realized. Again, my throat tries to choke the words back down. My father's got a thing for cripples. The words fly out between tears and spittle. And my mom's a fucking cripple. She had no idea he had this obsession when she married him. That's why she hates him so much. She thinks she's like the prize of his collection. I tell the group that after I found the video, I asked my mom about it. She seemed relieved she had someone to talk about it with, and told me what she already knew about his obsession. Like the pictures she'd found of my father when he was younger, bending limbs behind his back to look like an amputee. Eventually, we began investigating him together, and we found detailed inventories that he'd made of his photo collection of men and women with different amputations and birth defects. Everyone in the room is silent, even Joan. I press on, telling them that my mom never told my dad that she knows about this, that she made me promise never to say a word about it to anyone, that she constantly calls me to discuss new evidence she's found, that she's paranoid that he has cameras hidden in the house to record her, that she believes he meets regularly with a secret club of men who share his fixation, that she thinks he brings them photos of her and random disabled people he photographs in the streets, that she has such an overwhelming feeling of shame that she won't allow herself to be photographed and thinks anyone who stares at her must have a thing for her bad leg. She even found a film of their honeymoon he had edited so that it only contained scenes of her limping. I talk and talk and don't stop talking. I try to tell my mom that if she were a blonde with big breasts, people would stare and take photos and she wouldn't have a complex about it, so she should just think of it as an attractive feature. And finally, when the story is as exhausted as I am, I skid to a halt and return to my body. Was that so bad? Joan asks. I want to answer. Yes, it was that bad. I don't feel unburdened at all. I'm still carrying the secret. The only difference is that now 9 proven liars also know it. I feel vulnerable and sick to my stomach. Are you aware that sex addiction has a genetic component? She goes on. I don't know. I wish I hadn't told her. She's already using it against me, just like my mom warned me people would do. I know, she says firmly, as if a point has been proven. However, there's an issue here that's even bigger than your father's addiction and him leaking that energy all over the house. What do you mean? My face is crimson from fear, guilt, stress, fatigue. It's your bond with your mother, the way you keep secrets for her, the way you both investigated him together. I can perceive the faint outline of something important on the horizon of her words, but I can't seem to identify it. If you put what you just shared together with all the other pieces of your childhood, a clear pattern emerges. Which is what? She starts to speak, then stops herself. I don't know how you're going to take this. Just say it, I snap, imitating her just to be an asshole. This gives her the resolve she needs. She sucks in a breath of air, then exhales. Okay, I'll just say it. The pause is long. The room is quiet. My heart is hammering. And then she says it. Your mom wants to be in a relationship with you. It hits me like a ton of bricks. I sit there dazed, and a cold wind blows from somewhere inside me. Images from my life flutter in the current, each one a disturbing fragment of evidence. Why else would my mom come into my room at night and tell me all her problems? Why else would she not let me go on my first date? Why else was I grounded all the time and told that my classmates weren't really my friends? Why else wasn't I allowed the keys to the house when my brother was? Why else did she cut off all support and communication when I moved in with my first girlfriend, even though I was in my 20s? And what was I in this whole investigation of my father, if not her intimate partner? The tears come fast now. The statement seems so preposterous, yet something in my body recognizes the truth in it. Joan's got me. She's won. The pride, the ego, the defenses, the algebraic equations are all gone. I am at her mercy. And that's when she hammers once more on the stake she's just driven into me. That's why you're unable to be in a healthy relationship. Now it makes sense why there was a double standard between my brother and me. I choke out between sobs, regressing with each one. Like, after college, he could have his girlfriends spend the night at my parents' place, but I never could, even to this day. And why was that? Joan asks. She said they were never good enough for me, that I chose badly. It's not that you chose badly, she replies. She's found the blood in the water now. It's that you didn't choose Mom. My head is spinning. My mom didn't do this intentionally, I'm sure, but it was unconscious. She hated Dad. She didn't trust her friends, and I was the oldest, most reliable male around. So she probably wanted me all to herself, or at least safely under her control. When your mom is emotionally dependent on you, Joan goes on, and has intimate discussions with you that she should be having with her spouse, there's a name for that. She looks at me like a prize fighter sizing up a dazed opponent, then lands her final blow. It's called emotional incest. And I'm done.
Stage 3. Functional adult. The truth may be out there, but lies are inside your head. Terry Pratchett, Hogfather.
Chapter 20. Mexico City, many years earlier. Ready for school, princess? Her father asked. She glanced up at him. He was wearing a dark suit and looked like a movie star, an actor. She hated it when he talked to her like that. He had no right. He was rarely around and had never taken her to school before. He bent down and found her hand. She let it lie limply in his, like dough in an oven. She couldn't remember ever feeling the warmth of his hand before. Instead of taking her to the front door of the school, he led her to an alley alongside the building, where he met a short-haired brunette woman in a pencil skirt with high heels. He kissed her, but not the way the girl's grandmother kissed people. They kissed like lovers in the movies. In the days that followed, she conducted an investigation of her father, like in the detective shows she'd seen on TV. In an evidence box underneath her bed, she collected her father's beeper, full of messages from random women, his scheduling book, documenting appointments with them, and finally, tape recordings her father was secretly making of her mother talking on the phone. When she was ready to make her case, she sat her mother down and handed her the box. The little girl was nervous, not because of the effect it would have on her mom, but because the phone recordings contained evidence that she and her brother had been prank calling the butcher. Hello? Do you have pig's feet? Yes. Why don't you wash them? Click. Her mother didn't say a word as she went through the box. First she looked confused, then uncomfortable, and finally she started crying. The next day, her mother started her own investigation. In addition to discovering that her husband had several girlfriends on the side, she found out that not only had he never divorced his previous wife, but he was actually still living with her and having more children with her. So she confronted her husband about his double life and told him it was over between them. That night, the little girl was woken by screaming and a loud crash from her parents' bedroom. She ran to their door and pushed against it. but it was blocked by a broomstick. The doorknob had fallen off a few weeks back, so she looked through the hole to see what was going on. Her father was sitting on top of her mother, his face red and twisted as if possessed. His hands were over her mother's mouth and nose, squeezing tightly. She struggled to breathe, her hands clawing at his. Her eyes, grotesquely enlarged, appeared to turn toward the little girl, pleading, "Help me." "Please don't kill her," the little girl yelled between sobs as she tried to open the door. She rushed to her older brother's room and woke him up, and he ran into the hallway and slammed his body against the door, over and over again. As the door burst open, her father released his grip from her mother's face and backed away, telling his children that they were just playing. Her mother stumbled toward her, gasping violently, her face pale blue, her eyes blood red. And the little girl grabbed her hand and ran into the bathroom with her. She locked the door, and the two of them cried together. The boy ran to the phone to call their mom's brothers. They were all big men and very protective of their sister. But as the boy was yelling, "Help!" into the receiver, his father tore the cord out of the wall, pulled open the window of their fourth-floor apartment, and threw the phone outside. 10 minutes later, the girl emerged from the bathroom. The house was completely still. She heard classical music coming from the kitchen. There, she saw her dad, sitting at the table, his legs crossed gracefully. He was holding a glass of cognac, swirling it slowly, gazing at it with a look of complete peace as he breathed in the notes of the drink, the music, the night air. She yanked the needle off the record. "What are you doing?" she yelled, furious, confused, terrified. "I'm waiting for my death to arrive," he said calmly. That was the last time Ingrid saw her father. Chapter 21. I wake up alone in the rehab dorm, the sun diffusing through a small dirt-filmed window, the muffled mating calls of birds and cicadas announcing another morning, and a raging hard-on pressing against my boxer shorts. My mind drifts to an image of Carrie and the suggestive way she handed me her note. I remember she's roommates with Dawn, and I start picturing a threesome with them. I think about how her caretaking qualities must extend to the bedroom, and I imagine her using her breasts in considerate ways. Some guys are ass men. Others are into breasts, legs, or faces. My theory is that it has to do with the sexual position you prefer. If you like it doggy style, and you're looking at a woman's ass when you come, you're going to associate your sexual pleasure with that part of her body. If you like missionary, maybe you're a face man. And if you like her on top, you've usually got an eyeful and a handful of breasts when you orgasm. And if, fuck, I just made a mess in my boxer shorts. I waddle to the bathroom and wipe up. I feel like an alcoholic who smuggled a fifth of vodka into rehab and just guzzled it. As I get ready for the day, I think about a book Rick Rubin once showed me. It was about a 70s commune called the Source Family, which was run by a bank robber, vegetarian restaurant owner, and aspiring rock star known as Father Yod. In the book, there was a photo of him looking eerily like Rick, sitting outdoors in his commune in the Hollywood Hills, with 13 of his hippie wives and lovers gathered around him, at least two of them pregnant with his children. And I wonder what it would be like to live in an environment of open and unrestricted sexuality, with friends and lovers coming in and out freely, no one claiming ownership of another's body as if it were a personal possession. That's when I realize why today, of all days, my mind is spinning out of control. It's Sunday, and Ingrid is coming. The force of light, monogamy, stability, marriage, children, and a normal life is on her way. And now, my disease is blossoming like mold. Check-in, guilt, and shame. Guilt is about making a mistake, Shame is about being a mistake. And fear. 2 days earlier, when I was lying in a puddle in group therapy, seething over the violence of the phrase emotional incest, Joan suggested a couple of things. The first was that I call Ingrid and tell her what I'd learned about myself and why I'd cheated on her. The second was that I ask my parents to come for family week to work on healing our trauma and dysfunctional relationships with one another. As I masturbated, Ingrid was driving hundreds of miles to see me for the first time in weeks and talk about my recently diagnosed intimacy issues. I think of her driving so far all alone, and I'm touched she would do that for me after what I did to her. And how do I show my gratitude? By plotting orgies. I'm not a bad person, I tell myself. I'm just scared of intimacy. Unlike reaching out to Ingrid, calling my parents and telling them I was in rehab for sex addiction wasn't liable to be greeted with the same degree of support. So, like anyone faced with doing something emotionally difficult, I put it off until later. Every Sunday, all patients are required to attend family week graduation. So I walk across the property to a large classroom where a dozen addicts and trauma survivors sit with their families in the front of the room. One after another, sons, daughters, parents, siblings, and spouses stand up and talk about how the week has begun a much-needed healing process for them. A lot of times, people in a family think it's just one person who causes all the trouble. Lorraine, the therapist who lectured us on trauma, is telling the assembly. But a family is a system. And a sick person is the product of a sick system. As the ceremony continues, I feel a dry, sticky crunching in my navel hair. Evidently, I didn't wash away my sins well enough. I look around to see if it's possible to slip away, but then the freckly woman from Henry's rape and incest meeting rises from her seat and turns to face us. She's wearing black slacks and a blue cardigan and looks much less sallow than before. Almost upbeat, bordering on charismatic. She's standing next to a man in his late 60s with a large red face, a porcine body, and huge creviced hands. It is the adoptive father who molested her. I don't sense any hatred from her, nor any warmth. Someone looking at a photo of the two of them might think it was of a school teacher giving an old janitor an award for 40 years of dedicated service. If some of you remember, when I first arrived, I was very depressed and cried a lot and thought about killing myself, she is saying. I don't think I talked to anyone for my first 2 days here, but thanks to Family Week, I feel like a human being again. She turns to her father, and everyone sits stock still, waiting to hear what he has to say. It was very hard for me to make the decision to come here, he says. No shit. You're staring at a room full of trauma survivors who hate you. I feel very bad about what I've done. And I think Laura is an incredibly brave woman for being here and for allowing me to be here. I know nothing I can do or say will take away the past, but I'm happy that Laura can have a future now. I think I've grown more as a person with the therapist here than I have in my entire life. Listening to him, I resolved to call my parents. Since the day I left home for college, I've called my mom nearly every Sunday. The few times that I haven't, she's given me a guilt trip to remember. And it is a Sunday. Besides, if this woman could invite the monster who molested her to come, then surely I can ask a woman who merely grounded me a lot. Not only would it be good for my parents to face the truth, my mother and I have never told my dad that we know his secret. But maybe the family healing will relieve me of whatever is hanging over my head and standing in the way of having a happy, honest relationship. Chapter 22. Rehab, 1 hour later.
You're not a sex addict. You're a man. If someone wants to play with you, you're not going to walk away. What are you, a dork? You're going to play back.
The voice belongs to my mother. Yes, but not when I'm in a relationship.
In my book, that's how men do it. I believe in honesty in relationships, but if you're going to cheat, you got to keep it to yourself. As a woman, I've been asked out for coffee a couple times, and I say no thanks. But that's because I'm a woman, and it's not my nature. Though if he were a multimillionaire and he wasn't married, maybe I'd get coffee with him.
As I listen to her talk, I'm floored. I've never heard her views on fidelity before, except when she's disclosing the latest piece of evidence supporting her conviction that my father is having an affair. Yet here she is on the phone, making the exact same argument I've been making all week, except she's doing it her way. She continues.
I don't think you need treatment. Everything about you is going to be in those hospital files for the rest of your life, and the world's going to know about it. All you're addicted to is life and living it.
It's too late now, but I'm learning some things that will help my life. And the week after next, they have something called Family Week, when the parents of the people here visit. It really completes the healing process, and I wanted to see if both of you could come for it.
To go there would be useless.
I really need you and Dad here. It would mean so much to me, and it would help me a lot.
Listen, you're an unusual but normal person. If it were a life or death situation, we'd do it.
My father is also on the phone, but he doesn't say a word, except to apologize when my mother tells him he's breathing too loudly into the handset. No wonder I'm scared of marriage. Whenever someone I'm dating starts treating me worse than they treat a stranger, that's always the beginning of the end for me. What if I have a therapist from here call you and explain why it's important?
Don't you dare give anyone my phone number.
Okay, please, Mom. I don't know what to say.
There's nothing you can say. Physically, it's just very difficult to travel.
If they have therapists in Chicago they recommend, can we all go see one together?
I don't think so. There's nothing we could do or add. We don't feel you have a problem. Whatever problem you have, you know and we know.
It would help us connect. Remember my ex-girlfriend Lisa? When she saw us together, she said it didn't seem like there was any warmth or love between us.
Lisa was just with us for one meal. I wasn't comfortable with her. She wasn't friendly or smiling. She didn't relate to us at all.
Joan's words ring in my head as she speaks. Another example of the women I date not being good enough for my mother. The implicit message is that sex and affairs are okay, but don't get a real girlfriend, because that would be competition. I try using her own weapon against her. Guilt. As a mother, it would be one of the best things you could ever do for me.
How would it help you exactly?
It would help me be happier, healthier, incapable of having a functional relationship and starting a family of my own.
Charlie Aaron didn't get married until he was in his 70s, and he was never happier. And he didn't need any kids.
My breath catches in my throat. I've never heard of a mother who didn't want to be a grandmother. Every word coming out of her mouth seems to support Joan's horrific diagnosis. But remember Irving from high school? He said he didn't even know the meaning of the word love until he became a father.
Irving was your brother's friend?
No, he was my friend.
That's not possible. You were a dork. You didn't have any friends.
Why would a mother ever say that to her son, I wonder? Then I realize that I just recently learned the answer. She's keeping me in my place. I beg and plead for them to come, countering objection after objection, until she says flatly,
I really have some valid reasons why we can't come. We love you and we'd do anything else for you.
Hard to believe that right now. Can just Dad come then?
No way, Jose.
He says nothing. He has no voice in the relationship. I try one last angle, my ace in the hole, promising to keep the secret. Whatever you're worried about, and I think I know what it is, we don't have to discuss that.
I know who I am. I know who my parents are. I had an idyllic childhood. I think I turned out to be a great mother with two wonderful kids. I wouldn't change you 1 ounce. But if you're not satisfied with you, then you can help you by yourself. I'm not coming for personal reasons, very personal, and that's it. Tell them not to call.
The words fall like a sledgehammer, breaking the ground around me, isolating me, sending me spinning off into space alone. I reach for a lifeline. Can I ask you to just send me a copy of the keys to the house instead? They said it would give me a sense of closure if I could wear them around my neck as a symbol that I can be trusted. I realized that since leaving home for college, I've always had an odd key fixation. I've never thrown one away, even to old dorm rooms, cars, and apartments.
Sorry, Charlie. It's not you. It's me. I don't feel safe. And besides, you're absent-minded. You lost that tape recorder when you were 12 and a million other things. And I can't endanger my feeling of safety.
Okay. Thanks for listening. Bye, Mom.
We can hire 2 people and send them for family week instead if you want.
That's okay.
Enjoy your incarceration.
The world I once knew, the one I thought I grew up in. Strict, yes, but full of love and sacrifice from the parents who conceived, nurtured, and supported me, is gone. What she's saying, ultimately, is that her issues are more important than my well-being, and they always have been. It could be worse, though. At least she has a sense of humor. Chapter 23. I shower for a second time, making sure to use a washcloth, soap, and pressure, then trudge to a men's circle in progress on the lawn. The 30 or so guys there are using what they call a talking stick, and only the person holding the erect cock-sized piece of wood can speak. When he's done, he says, "Aho," which is some sort of macho Native American sound, and hands the wooden dick to the next lunatic. "Hi, I'm Calvin, and I'm a sex addict. And I'm feeling a lot of fear right now, but also joy, because Mariana, the Brazilian prostitute he impregnated, just told me she wants to keep the baby. Aho." He hands me the stick. It's my turn to check in, and I want to get it over with quickly. "I'm Neil, and I'm tired of labels, and I'm fine. Aho." Everyone sucks in air, or exclaims, "Ooh," like I've just stepped in shit. "What?" I ask. Charles gestures for me to hand him the stick. I shake my head in annoyance and hand it to him. Idiotic rule. Fine stands for fucked up, insecure, neurotic, and emotional, he says. That's about right. The men glare at me in silent accusation. I spoke without holding the talking stick. You'd think I just shot someone. Charles hands me the talking dick, and I place it on the ground next to me. I love how someone can just make up a random fucking rule, and you all follow it like sheep, I tell them as I walk off. I've been in a fucking men's circle all week anyway. Aho. No one responds, because no one is holding the talking stick. I'm aware, as I walk away, that I'm not really mad at them. And I'm not mad at the talking stick. It's actually a decent rule. If I'd had the chance to speak uninterrupted as a child, and express myself, and truly be heard, I'd probably be much healthier. What I'm mad about is that some people's parents can't come to family week because they're dead or broke or in prison, but my parents just won't. A guy who molested his daughter has the balls to show up here. As for my father, he doesn't even have the balls to speak up for himself on the phone. Check-in, fucked up, insecure, neurotic, and emotional, and rethinking everything I thought I knew about my childhood, my life, and who I am. The perfect frame of mind to see Ingrid after all this time apart. Chapter 24. She is too pure for this place. She stands in the nurse's area, where I'm now allowed the occasional use of my razor under supervision only. She's wearing a fitted blue plaid button-down shirt that's open to reveal a triangle of flawless skin and black jeans that stop just above her high heels. No one wears high heels in this place. It's not healthy for the fragile libidos here. She stiffens as she sees me, and everything comes up at once in her face. The love, the hate, the desire, the fear, the hope, the hurt, and pushes through the scab covering it all. The words, "Oh my God," escape from her mouth. Then the tears roll. When we hug, it seems like she's dissolving into me. But when I feel her shirt rubbing against my chafed navel, a sense of unworthiness sweeps over me. Here I am, lusting after every slightly attractive inpatient I see, while she's come all this way, hoping I've changed. I guess I'm here because I want to be as good a person as Ingrid is. What I'm feeling right now is another symptom of my trauma. It's shame again. I'm putting myself one down, where I belong. Suddenly, a fragment of my past comes rushing back. I'm a teenager, lying in bed, imagining what my life will be like in the future. It's always the same scene. My brother is living in a large suburban house with a big green lawn and a beautiful blonde wife. I visit and ask if I can stay for a while because I have nowhere else to go. My clothes are dirty and wrinkled, and my face is unshaven. I crash on his couch, emitting a funny smell and watching TV, until one day, his perfectly put-together wife asks him, as politely as can be, "Is your brother ever going to get a job? He can't stay on this couch forever." And now, 2 decades later, I actually managed to achieve the happy life I never thought possible. A home, a job, a girlfriend oddly similar to the wife I imagined my brother with, and I wreck it. It's as if the prediction didn't come true, so I willed it to be. I fucked it to life. "What are you thinking about?" Ingrid asks. "I'm just happier here." There's an energy between us. It's a stronger feeling than I get with anyone else, like the pull of two magnets held just slightly apart. "What's in your hand?" she asks. "It's my timeline. I want to explain it to you so you can know who I am." We walk to the lawn and sit in the grass near where the men's circle was. It's just below the patient lounge, and I notice the sex addicts clustered along the outdoor benches above. They also seem taken in by Ingrid's magnetism. I wonder if they're thinking of being with their wives or of cheating on their wives. Ingrid listens closely as I walk her through each event on my timeline. But when I reveal the punchline, emotional incest, she strains to understand. How is that incest? I know, I hate the term. Everything is diagnosed as some sort of crippling psychological disorder here. It feels so good to be talking with her, sharing with her, smelling her again, that despite the subject matter, I'm giddy with happiness. "But this is what pertains to us," I continue. "They say here that if you tell them what kind of relationship you had with your opposite sex parent as a child, they can tell you what kind of romantic relationship you're going to have as an adult. Unless you're gay, in which case it would be the same sex parent." "I don't know," she responds. "That sounds oversimplified." "Maybe it is," I tell her. "I have no idea what's true anymore. Ever since presenting my timeline, my head's been a mess. So I explain to Ingrid what I've learned since that afternoon." "They say here that there are 3 ways of raising children. The first is functional bonding, in which the parents or primary caregivers love, nurture, affirm, set healthy limits with, and take care of the needs of the child." I turn over my timeline and sketch it for her. "This creates a child who has healthy, secure self-esteem and relationships. But then there's neglect, when a caregiver abandons, is detached from, or doesn't appropriately nurture the child. This can range from a parent who isn't physically present to a parent who is physically present but emotionally distant, to a parent who doesn't provide adequate care or safety, to a parent lost in a work, sex, gambling, alcohol, or other addiction. If you grew up feeling unwanted by or unimportant to a parent, this is a sign that neglect likely occurred. This creates wounded children who are often depressed and indecisive, see themselves as flawed and less valuable than others, and feel they can't face the world alone. In relationships, they tend to have what's called anxious attachment. They may feel like they're not enough for their partners, become so wrapped up in their relationships that they lose sight of their own needs and self-worth, and be emotionally intense, passive-aggressive, or in need of constant reassurance that they're not being abandoned. Here, they call this type of person a love addict. As Ingrid listens intently, I look for any recognition in her eyes. After all, she was abandoned by her father throughout her childhood, even before he tried to kill her mother and narrowly escaped her uncles. When I see none, I move on to explain the third type of parenting, enmeshment. This is my upbringing. Instead of taking care of a child's needs, the enmeshing parent tries to get his or her own needs met through the child. This can take various forms. A parent who lives through a child's accomplishments, who makes the child a surrogate spouse, therapist, or caretaker, who is depressed and emotionally uses the child, who is overbearing or over-controlling, or who is excessively emotional or anxious about a child. If you grew up feeling sorry for or smothered by a parent, this is a sign that enmeshment likely occurred. In the process, enmeshed children lose their sense of self. As adults, they usually avoid letting anyone get too close and suck the life out of them again. Where the abandoned are often unable to contain their feelings, the enmeshed tend to be cut off from them and be perfectionistic and controlling of themselves and others. Though they may pursue a relationship thinking they want connection, once they're in the reality of one, they often put up walls, feel superior, and use other distancing techniques to avoid intimacy. This is known as avoidant attachment, or, as they put it here, love avoidance. And most sex addicts, according to this theory, are love avoidants. I tell Ingrid that I asked if there was a fourth category for physically or sexually abusive parenting, but I was told that this could register on a child as either neglectful or enmeshing. They explained that a rule of thumb to use is that when a parent's abuse disempowers a child, that's neglect. When it's falsely empowering, that's enmeshment. Ingrid blinks back tears, places her rock, paper, scissors playing hand warmly over mine, and says, "I would give up anything to see you healed and free of the enmeshment that's keeping you from living." In the past, I would have thought this was the most beautiful thing in the world to say. Now, instead, I worry that wanting to give up anything for someone else's happiness is a dysfunctional symptom of love addiction and codependence. Then I worry that being scared by her selfless caring is a symptom of my own love avoidance. They're really screwing up my mind in here. "I'm working hard on it," I tell her. "Wait. That's not completely true. Some of the stuff here is a little too over the top for me, though." "That's better. I think this is going to be the best thing that ever happened to you," she responds. And for the first time since I cheated on her, I see the light return to her eyes. "Do you really think so?" I ask her. "I know it," she responds. "I've never told you this, but I was in rehab for 2 years." Chapter 25. "So all you really want in a relationship is freedom?" Ingrid asks as we walk to the cafeteria for dinner later that day. "Yeah, I think so." "I'd like to give you more freedom then." "Really?" "Yes, starting now." She grabs my jeans playfully and starts pulling them down. "This is what freedom feels like." An impish smile, which I've sorely missed, spreads across her face. "Why don't you show everyone here your freedom?" she mocks, pulling next at my boxer shorts. I yank the waistband up to keep from exposing myself. If Joan saw this, she'd probably add compulsive exhibitionist to my permanent record. But Ingrid keeps fighting to remove my clothing, yelling, "Freedom!" at the top of her lungs. We walk into the cafeteria, grinning ear to ear. She's making a joke out of the issue all us red demons have been tying ourselves in knots over. Perhaps the best cure is just to lighten up. I don't need Zoloft. I have her. "Miss, you're going to have to button your shirt higher. The dining hall counselor and anorexic feeder barks when he sees her, as if the sex addicts are going to break into spontaneous public masturbation when they see that extra inch of cleavage. We each grab a plate of flavorless chicken parts over soapy rice and walk to the sex addict table. Troy claps me on the back and says idiotically, "You didn't tell us how hot she was." Maybe the counselor was right after all. Charles doesn't leave the table as we sit down, which means visitors are presumably exempt from the males-only rule. Ingrid asks each guy in the group about his story, and each speaks freely of his sins, except for Charles. Then she tells them her family story. My grandfather cheated on my grandmother all the time, but she always loved him. After he died, she started having recurring nightmares about him cheating. So every morning, she goes to his room and yells at his ashes, "Dios mío, even in death you are still cheating on me. Can't you let me be, you dirty old man?" The guys laugh all too knowingly. Then, Ingrid continues, a few hours later, she returns, apologizes, dusts the room, and refreshes the flowers on his nightstand. And so, even in death, in relationship with a memory, the ballad of the love addict and love avoider continues. Ingrid's mother was just as obsessive a love addict. She used to be beautiful and independent and have her own TV show in Mexico, Ingrid tells the guys. But when we moved to America, she became a domestic slave to my stepfather. I tried to get her to leave him because he was so emotionally abusive, but she'd always say, "I can't. What am I going to do when you both turn 18? I'm going to be left alone." "Maybe that's the female dilemma," Troy cuts in. "She marries someone who's giving her love and romance, but over time, she gets taken for granted, or turned into a maid, or becomes a baby factory, or gets cheated on. There's not a single emotional need of hers that's filled by her husband. Then he has the nerve to complain that she's not sexual or attractive when he's drained the life out of her." As the guys nod in sad recognition, Ingrid quickly summarizes her teenage years, some of which she'd never shared even with me before. Her stepfather treated her worse than a servant, making her do backbreaking work, refusing to let her dine at the table with the rest of the family, and giving her an unheated garage without any furniture as a room. Ingrid soon slid from a straight A student to a straight F student. Eventually, she ran away, started doing meth, and spent 2 years living in rehab because her stepfather wouldn't let her back in the house. She ended up becoming the youth spokesperson for the treatment center, appearing on the news and speaking at events with the mayor. Yet despite separating from her family and accomplishing so much on her own afterward, she still followed in her mother and grandmother's footsteps and fell in love with a cheater. After dinner, the anorexic feeder curtly tells Ingrid that visiting hours are over. As we head back to reception, Henry, my new friend from the art room, falls in step with us and starts speaking in a slow monotone, ignoring Ingrid. "They talk about how there are 8 emotions here, but I think there are 9. What's the other one?" "The 9th emotion is the death emotion. It's just feeling nothing." "We're fragile beings," I think as I see the pain in his face. Even when the body heals, the soul remains scarred. As we talk, he slowly becomes aware of Ingrid's presence and asks if she's my girlfriend. I turn to Ingrid, and our eyes search each other's for an answer. I've done my penance and shown a willingness to change by checking in here. She has shown her forgiveness by driving here to see me and sharing her own secrets. "Yes," she tells him, "I am." Relief and gratitude flow through me. I'm done fantasizing about the women here. I've been given a second chance not to be Ingrid's father and grandfather, or to be them and perpetuate the multi-generational pattern of cheating men and the women who love them. The sins of the parents are the destinies of the children, unless the children wake up and do something about it. "I trust your boyfriend," Henry says. "I feel like I can talk to him. Of course he can, I think. I must give out some sort of enmeshment signal, letting everyone know they can confide their crazy shit in me. That's probably why I ended up profiling rock stars for Rolling Stone. Why all those mistrustful celebrities felt comfortable divulging private thoughts to me that they never shared with anyone else. Why my editors clapped me on the back afterward and put the story on the cover. Childhood trauma may sneak up from behind and fuck you in the ass when you grow up, but at least it leaves a tip on the nightstand. Who was that poor guy? Ingrid asks as Henry drifts away, talking about his latest suicide plan. He's identified the most dangerous patient here and is planning to pick a fight with him. He had sex with a horse, I tell her. And the horse got jealous and told his wife? She jokes, though there's a barb in there that I ignore. As we hug goodbye in reception, I try to imprint the softness of her breasts against my chest, the ridges of her spine beneath my fingertips, the warmth of her cheek against mine, so I can remember them when I get weak. My biggest wish is that you find your inner peace and happiness, she says as she pulls away. Thank you for believing in me, I tell her, my girlfriend, my lover, my jailer. After she leaves, I sit on a bench outside the patient lounge, and tears come to my eyes. She seems to love me unconditionally, but I fear that I love her conditionally. I look at her sometimes and worry that she's going to get wide hips like her mother, or I wonder if I'll still be able to make love to her when she's fat and wrinkly. Other times, I pick apart her existing features, looking for flaws and imperfections. The sad thing is, I certainly have a lot more imperfections she could pick apart. I'm short, bald, bony, and big-nosed, with huge greasy pores. I'm lucky to have her. And I wonder, am I even capable of love? Have I ever truly loved anyone? I can't tell whether my tears are for the beauty of her love or the sadness of my incapacity to feel worthy of it. Chapter 26. As a journalist, I've met a lot of so-called experts. Most are just people with a little experience and a lot of confidence who've given themselves a title with which they can fool the suggestible and dim-witted. But every now and then, I come across someone who has the experience, knowledge, and calling to be not just a teacher dispensing information, but a guide leading others to themselves. And Lorraine seems to be one of them. Self-deprecation is still self-worship, she is telling Calvin. It's the flip side of the same coin. It's still about self. It's our second week here, and the staff has divided us into smaller groups to experience a gestalt-like therapy they call chair work. Adam, Calvin, Troy, and I, the troublemakers, have, to our relief, been placed under Lorraine's care in a nearby building, and she's in the midst of prepping us to undergo this intense form of trauma healing. I suck at self-deprecation, I whisper to Calvin. Lorraine overhears and says sternly, remember that humor is a wall. It's a form of denial, just the same as repression, rationalization, globalization, and minimization. Yes, I think she is one of those experts. It's clear she's dealt with enough stupid smart people that she can read me like a book. That afternoon, Lorraine rips open everyone's minds. As she lectures on the human psyche, sex addicts' faces illuminate intermittently like fireworks as they realize the origins of their behaviors, their feelings, and the beliefs that have kept them estranged from others and ultimately themselves. Unlike traditional talk therapy, in which a therapist sits with a client in an office for an hour every week for years or even decades, addiction treatment has to change people quickly. Lives are at stake. That next drink could lead to a burst vein. That next injection could be a hot one. What matters is what works today, not what's been studied and accepted by the mainstream psychiatric community. And so some say the techniques here, many of them adapted from the decades-old work of a former nurse, Pia Melody, who as of this moment doesn't even have her own Wikipedia entry, are problematic. Others say they are the pinnacle of personal transformation, if you're lucky enough to get the right counselor. And we were lucky enough to get Lorraine, the only person I've encountered here so far who doesn't seem burned out or embittered by the Sisyphean task of healing damaged minds she can't touch or see. So take a deep breath, listen carefully, and drift back to the way you saw the world at age 6 or 9 or 12 as I summarize Lorraine's lectures and the philosophy here. Everything that's wrong with your behavior and why in 1800 words or less. In the beginning, you were born, and like all infants, you were completely vulnerable and dependent, with a new developing brain and no understanding of the world. In a perfect world, your parents would be perfect. They would be dedicated full-time to taking care of your physical and psychological needs, always making the right decisions, setting the healthiest boundaries, and protecting you from all harm while preparing you to eventually take care of your needs without them. But in the real world, no one is perfect, neither your parents nor the other people who play a role in your upbringing. Therefore, along the way, some of your developmental needs don't get met. And the problem is, when one of your needs doesn't get met, however big or small, it can leave a wound. These wounds are known as childhood trauma. Each instance or pattern of trauma can create specific core personal issues and relationship challenges. And if these are left untreated, you're likely to pass your wounds on to the next generation. Since this trauma occurs early in life, it can affect social, emotional, behavioral, cognitive, and moral development. It's not always overt or intentional. Most commonly, people think of trauma as coming from hateful perpetrators who are knowingly and willfully abusive. But even parents who think of themselves as loving or well-meaning make mistakes, cross boundaries, or simply do their best with the limited internal resources they have. And this covert, often unrecognized abuse can, through its constant repetition, leave wounds just as deep as those created by a single malicious act. It can be an emotional scar. In your earliest years, you're the center of the universe. Everything revolves around you. So wounds can come from caregivers who are either out of control or completely detached from their emotions around you. When mom is always full of anxiety as she's breastfeeding, or dad comes home in a rage every time he has a rough day at work, or stepdad is depressed by his money problems during the rare moments he spends with you, you soak up these emotions like a sponge, often erroneously taking the blame or responsibility for them. Even if a parent falls ill and passes away, it can seem like abandonment or something you made happen if you're too young to understand death. It can be physical. Most people understand that it's not okay to physically harm or even spank a child. But here's an example that's not as obvious. Any invasive medical procedure, even something as commonplace as a circumcision or getting stitches, may register the exact same as physical abuse if you experience it in your first few years of life. You may even start to distrust your caregivers for bringing you to an unfamiliar place and not keeping you safe. Often, it's intellectual. After the first few years of life, you start to separate from your parents. In this period, it's their job to help you become your own person and confidently stand on your own two feet in the world. Here, a whole new set of problems can arise, especially when parents try to overcontrol you, habitually criticize you, or unreasonably expect you to be perfect. Other families adhere to such rigid rules that any manifestation of a child's individuality is immediately attacked as a threat. All these can lead to esteem problems later in life. Or it can take over your entire identity. Within a dysfunctional family system, each child tends to play a different role that helps the family survive and detracts from its real issues. These can include the revered hero, the troublemaking scapegoat, the neglected lost child, the people-pleasing placator, and the mood-lifting mascot. Later in life, these roles, as well as birth order, can lead to corresponding personality issues, whether it's the hero's judgmental perfectionism, the scapegoat's explosive anger, the lost child's low self-esteem, the placator's denial of personal needs, or the mascot's impulsive irresponsibility. But it's not easy to see your own core issues. Your oldest beliefs, behaviors, and adaptations have not just been reinforced by decades of habit, but are built deep into the architecture of your brain, which is busy building new neural connections at an astounding rate in early life. As the saying goes, cells that fire together wire together. So trying to see yourself with any objectivity can be like trying to touch your right elbow with your right hand. But if you can detach from yourself a little bit, you'll notice that the things you do and think don't just come out of nowhere. Here are a few techniques and tools you can use to better understand the way your past can interfere with your happiness, your relationships, and your life today. You can work backward. Are you relentlessly driving yourself to succeed and beating yourself up when you fail? Maybe that's because when you were a teenager, your parents made you feel as if your worth as a human being was dependent on your grades, touchdowns, or accomplishments. Are you out of touch with your emotions because stepdad always told you to toughen up when you cried? Do you feel deep down like you don't matter because you were often ignored growing up? Are you always trying to save or care for others because you were never able to save mom from her depression or addiction? Are you in complete denial that anything was wrong with your family because dad acted as if he were infallible and must be unquestioningly obeyed, so criticizing him would be like blaspheming God? Are you getting the hang of this yet? You can excuse my language. Some of you have a big bag of shit you're carrying around, and every time you encounter a situation in which you can possibly get more shit to put in the bag, you grab it and stuff it inside. You'll even ignore all the diamonds glittering nearby because all you can see is the shit. This shit is known as the stories you tell yourself. Examples include generalizations like, I make bad decisions. If people saw the real me, they wouldn't like me. Or conversely, no one is good enough for me. Each of these beliefs can be formed in childhood by, respectively, fault-finding parents, abandoning parents, and parents who put you on a pedestal. As a result, you can spend much of your life misinterpreting situations and thinking you found more evidence to support these false conclusions formed in childhood. One way to recognize when you're stuck in your own story is whenever you feel less than or better than others. Here's a tool you can use to assess your own behavior. There are three developmental states. The first is the wounded child, someone who's emotionally frozen between the ages of 0 and 5. The second is the adapted adolescent, who's emotionally frozen between the ages of 6 and 18. And finally, there's the functional adult, who's emotionally mature. So where the wounded child feels worthless and the adapted adolescent may feel arrogant, the functional adult gets their esteem from within. Where the wounded child is extremely needy and the adapted adolescent is needless, the functional adult communicates his or her needs. Where the wounded child acts out of control and the adapted adolescent is hyper-controlling, the functional adult is flexible and moderate. Where the wounded child seeks attention and the adapted adolescent seeks intensity, the functional adult lives in integrity and harmony. Where wounded children idealize their caretakers or partners, and adapted adolescents feel disillusioned by their caretakers or partners, functional adults are in reality about their caretakers or partners. So ask yourself, in a given week, do you exhibit any of the wounded child or adolescent behaviors here? If so, you may have either gotten stuck somewhere along the way in your emotional or behavioral development, or certain situations are causing you to revert to those ages. Any time you overreact to something by shutting down, losing your temper, sulking, feeling hopeless, freaking out, disassociating, or any of numerous other dysfunctional behaviors, it's typically because an old wound has been triggered, and you're regressing to the childhood or adolescent state that corresponds to that feeling. Note that the wounded child tends to directly internalize the messages that caretakers give, while the adapted adolescent tends to react against them. However, not everyone reacts to the same trauma in the same way. And children are born with different predispositions and resiliencies. So if you remain loyal to people who abuse and mistreat you, that's called trauma bonding. If you only feel normal if you're doing something extreme or high risk, that's trauma arousal. If you've developed intense self-loathing, you've got trauma shame. If you find chemical, mental, or technological ways to numb yourself and your feelings, that's trauma blocking. And it goes on and on. One pattern of trauma, many different possible responses to it. We've only scratched the surface, but at least you know the model we're working with here. It's not about blaming, but understanding. In summary, we each spend our adult lives running on a unique operating system that took some 18 years to program and is full of distinct bugs and viruses.